Even on rare occasions when rulers tried to intervene more intensively in the daily lives of the peasantry, as happened, for example, in the Qin Empire in China, they did so by converting family heads and community elders into government agents. Often enough, transportation and communication difficulties made it so difficult to intervene in the affairs of remote communities that many kingdoms preferred to cede even the most basic royal prerogatives, such as taxation and violence, to communities. The Ottoman Empire, for instance, allowed family vendettas to mete out justice, rather than supporting a large imperial police force. If my cousin killed somebody, the victim's brother might kill me in sanctioned revenge. The Sultan in Istanbul, or even the provincial Pasha, did not intervene in such clashes, as long as violence remained within acceptable limits. In the Chinese Ming Empire, 1368 to 1644, the population was organized into the Baojia system. 10 families were grouped to form a jia, and 10 jia constituted a bao. When a member of a bao committed a crime, other bao members could be punished for it, in particular the bao elders. Taxes, too, were levied on the bao, and it was the responsibility of the bao elders, rather than of the state officials, to assess the situation of each family and determine the amount of tax it should pay. From the empire's perspective, this system had a huge advantage. Instead of maintaining thousands of revenue officials and tax collectors who would have to monitor the earnings and expenses of every family, these tasks were left to the community elders. The elders knew how much each villager was worth, and they could usually enforce tax payments without involving the imperial army. Many kingdoms and empires were, in truth, little more than large protection rackets. The king was the capo di tutti capi, who collected protection money, and in return made sure that the neighbouring crime syndicates and local small fry did not harm those under his protection. He did little else. Life in the bosom of family and community was far from ideal. Families and communities could oppress their members no less brutally than do modern states and markets, and their internal dynamics were often fraught with tension and violence. Yet people had little choice. A person who lost her family and community around 1750 was as good as dead. She had no job, no education, and no support in times of sickness and distress. Nobody would lend her money or defend her if she got into trouble. There were no policemen, no social workers, and no compulsory education. In order to survive, such a person quickly had to find an alternative family or community. Boys and girls who ran away from home could expect, at best, to become servants in some new family. At worst, there was the army or the brothel. All this changed dramatically over the last two centuries. The Industrial Revolution gave the market immense new powers, provided the state with new means of communication and transportation, and placed at the government's disposal an army of clerks, teachers, policemen, and social workers. At first, the market and the state discovered their path blocked by traditional families and communities who had little love for outside intervention. Parents and community elders were reluctant to let the younger generation be indoctrinated by nationalist education systems, conscripted into armies, or turned into a rootless urban proletariat. Over time, states and markets used their growing power to weaken the traditional bonds of family and community. The state sent its policemen to stop family vendettas and replace them with court decisions. The market sent its hawkers to wipe out long-standing local traditions and replace them with ever-changing commercial fashions. Yet this was not enough. In order really to break the power of family and community, they needed the help of a fifth column. The state and the market approached people with an offer that could not be refused. "Become individuals," they said. "Marry whomever you desire, without asking permission from your parents. Take up whatever job suits you, even if community elders frown. Live wherever you wish, even if you cannot make it every week to the family dinner. You are no longer dependent on your family or your community. We, the state and the market, will take care of you instead. We will provide food, shelter, education, health, welfare, and employment. We will provide pensions, insurance, and protection." Romantic literature often presents the individual as somebody caught in a struggle against the state and the market. Nothing could be further from the truth. The state and the market are the mother and father of the individual, and the individual can survive only thanks to them. The market provides us with work, insurance, and a pension. If we want to study a profession, the government schools are there to teach us. If we want to open a business, the bank loans us money. If we want to build a house, a construction company builds it, and the bank gives us a mortgage, in some cases subsidized or insured by the state. If violence flares up, the police protect us. If we are sick for a few days, our health insurance takes care of us. If we are debilitated for months, National Social Services steps in. If we need around-the-clock assistance, we can go to the market and hire a nurse, usually some stranger from the other side of the world who takes care of us with the kind of devotion that we no longer expect from our own children. If we have the means, we can spend our golden years at a senior citizen's home. The tax authorities treat us as individuals and do not expect us to pay the neighbor's taxes. The courts, too, see us as individuals and never punish us for the crimes of our cousins. Not only adult men, but also women and children are recognized as individuals. Throughout most of history, women were often seen as the property of family or community. Modern states, on the other hand, see women as individuals, enjoying economic and legal rights independently of their family and community. They may hold their own bank accounts, decide whom to marry, and even choose to divorce or live on their own. But the liberation of the individual comes at a cost. Many of us now bewail the loss of strong families and communities, and feel alienated and threatened by the power the impersonal state and market wield over our lives. States and markets composed of alienated individuals can intervene in the lives of their members much more easily than states and markets composed of strong families and communities. When neighbors in a high-rise apartment building cannot even agree on how much to pay their janitor, how can we expect them to resist the state? The deal between states, markets, and individuals is an uneasy one. The state and the market disagree about their mutual rights and obligations, and individuals complain that both demand too much and provide too little. In many cases, individuals are exploited by markets, and states employ their armies, police forces, and bureaucracies to persecute individuals instead of defending them. Yet it is amazing that this deal works at all, however imperfectly. For it breaches countless generations of human social arrangements. Millions of years of evolution have designed us to live and think as community members. Within a mere two centuries, we have become alienated individuals. Nothing testifies better to the awesome power of culture. The nuclear family did not disappear completely from the modern landscape. When states and markets took from the family most of its economic and political roles, they left it some important emotional functions. The modern family is still supposed to provide for intimate needs, which state and market are, so far, incapable of providing. Yet even here the family is subject to increasing interventions. The market shapes to an ever greater degree the way people conduct their romantic and sexual lives. Whereas traditionally the family was the main matchmaker, today it's the market that tailors our romantic and sexual preferences and then lends a hand in providing for them, for a fat fee. Previously, bride and groom met in the family living room, and money passed from the hands of one father to another. Today, courting is done at bars and cafes, and money passes from the hands of lovers to waitresses. Even more money is transferred to the bank accounts of fashion designers, gym managers, dietitians, cosmeticians, and plastic surgeons, who help us arrive at the cafe looking as similar as possible to the market's ideal of beauty. The state, too, keeps a sharper eye on family relations, especially between parents and children. In many countries, parents are obliged to send their children to be educated in government schools, and even where private education is allowed, the state still supervises and vets the curriculum. Parents who are especially abusive or violent with their children may be restrained by the state. If need be, the state may even imprison the parents or transfer their children to foster families. Until not long ago, the suggestion that the state ought to prevent parents from beating or humiliating their children would have been rejected out of hand as ludicrous and unworkable. In most societies, parental authority was sacred. Respect of and obedience to one's parents were among the most hallowed values, and parents could do almost anything they wanted, including killing newborn babies, selling children into slavery, and marrying off daughters to men more than twice their age. Today, parental authority is in full retreat. Youngsters are increasingly excused from obeying their elders, whereas parents are blamed for anything that goes wrong in the life of their child. Mum and Dad are about as likely to be found innocent in the Freudian courtroom as were defendants in a Stalinist show trial. Imagined communities. Like the nuclear family, the community could not completely disappear from our world without any emotional replacement. Markets and states today provide most of the material needs once provided by communities, but they must also supply tribal bonds. Markets and states do so by fostering imagined communities that contain millions of strangers and which are tailored to national and commercial needs. An imagined community is a community of people who don't really know each other, but imagine that they do. Such communities are not a novel invention. Kingdoms, empires, and churches functioned for millennia as imagined communities. In ancient China, tens of millions of people saw themselves as members of a single family, with the emperor as its father. In the Middle Ages, millions of devout Muslims imagined that they were all brothers and sisters in the great community of Islam. Yet throughout history, such imagined communities played second fiddle to intimate communities of several dozen people who knew each other well. The intimate communities fulfilled the emotional needs of their members and were essential for everyone's survival and welfare. In the last two centuries, the intimate communities have withered, leaving imagined communities to fill in the emotional vacuum. The two most important examples for the rise of such imagined communities are the nation and the consumer tribe. The nation is the imagined community of the state. The consumer tribe is the imagined community of the market. Both are imagined communities because it is impossible for all customers in a market or for all members of a nation really to know one another the way villagers knew one another in the past. No German can intimately know the other 80 million members of the German nation, or the other 500 million customers inhabiting the European Common Market, which evolved first into the European Community and finally became the European Union. Consumerism and nationalism work extra hours to make us imagine that millions of strangers belong to the same community as ourselves, that we all have a common past, common interests, and a common future. This isn't a lie. It's imagination. Like money, limited liability companies, and human rights, nations and consumer tribes are intersubjective realities. They exist only in our collective imagination, yet their power is immense. As long as millions of Germans believe in the existence of a German nation, get excited at the sight of German national symbols, retell German national myths, and are willing to sacrifice money, time, and limbs for the German nation, Germany will remain one of the strongest powers in the world. The nation does its best to hide its imagined character. Most nations argue that they are a natural and eternal entity, created in some primordial epoch by mixing the soil of the motherland with the blood of the people. Yet such claims are usually exaggerated. Nations existed in the distant past, but their importance was much smaller than today, because the importance of the state was much smaller. A resident of medieval Nuremberg might have felt some loyalty towards the German nation, but she felt far more loyalty towards her family and local community, which took care of most of her needs. Moreover, whatever importance ancient nations may have had, few of them survived. Most existing nations evolved only after the Industrial Revolution. The Middle East provides ample examples. The Syrian, Lebanese, Jordanian, and Iraqi nations are the product of haphazard borders drawn in the sand by French and British diplomats who ignored local history, geography, and economy. These diplomats determined in 1918 that the people of Kurdistan, Baghdad, and Basra would henceforth be Iraqis. It was primarily the French who decided who would be Syrian and who Lebanese. Saddam Hussein and Hafez al-Assad tried their best to promote and reinforce their Anglo-French manufactured national consciousness, but their bombastic speeches about the allegedly eternal Iraqi and Syrian nations had a hollow ring. It goes without saying that nations cannot be created from thin air. Those who worked hard to construct Iraq or Syria made use of real historical, geographical, and cultural raw materials, some of which are centuries and millennia old. Saddam Hussein co-opted the heritage of the Abbasid Caliphate and the Babylonian Empire, even calling one of his crack armoured units the Hammurabi Division. Yet that does not turn the Iraqi nation into an ancient entity. If I bake a cake from flour, oil, and sugar, all of which have been sitting in my pantry for the past 2 months, it does not mean that the cake itself is 2 months old. In recent decades, national communities have been increasingly eclipsed by tribes of customers who do not know one another intimately, but share the same consumption habits and interests, and therefore feel part of the same consumer tribe, and define themselves as such. This sounds very strange, but we are surrounded by examples. Madonna fans, for example, constitute a consumer tribe. They define themselves largely by shopping. They buy Madonna concert tickets, CDs, posters, shirts, and ringtones, and thereby define who they are. Manchester United fans, vegetarians, and environmentalists are other examples. They, too, are defined above all by what they consume. It is the keystone of their identity. A German vegetarian might well prefer to marry a French vegetarian than a German carnivore. Perpetuum mobile. The revolutions of the last two centuries have been so swift and radical that they have changed the most fundamental characteristic of the social order. Traditionally, the social order was hard and rigid. Order implied stability and continuity. Swift social revolutions were exceptional, and most social transformations resulted from the accumulation of numerous small steps. Humans tended to assume that the social structure was inflexible and eternal. Families and communities might struggle to change their place within the order, but the idea that you could change the fundamental structure of the order was alien. People tended to reconcile themselves to the status quo, declaring that this is how it always was, and this is how it always will be. Over the last two centuries, the pace of change became so quick that the social order acquired a dynamic and malleable nature. It now exists in a state of permanent flux. When we speak of modern revolutions, we tend to think of 1789, the French Revolution, 1848, the liberal revolutions, or 1917, the Russian Revolution. But the fact is that these days, every year is revolutionary. Today, even a 30-year-old can honestly tell disbelieving teenagers, "When I was young, the world was completely different." The Internet, for example, came into wide usage only in the early 1990s, hardly 20 years ago. Today, we cannot imagine the world without it. Hence, any attempt to define the characteristics of modern society is akin to defining the color of a chameleon. The only characteristic of which we can be certain is the incessant change. People have become used to this, and most of us think about the social order as something flexible, which we can engineer and improve at will. The main promise of pre-modern rulers was to safeguard the traditional order, or even to go back to some lost golden age. In the last two centuries, the currency of politics is that it promises to destroy the old world and build a better one in its place. Not even the most conservative of political parties vows merely to keep things as they are. Everybody promises social reform, educational reform, economic reform, and they often fulfill those promises. Just as geologists expect that tectonic movements will result in earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, So might we expect that drastic social movements will result in bloody outbursts of violence. The political history of the 19th and 20th centuries is often told as a series of deadly wars, holocausts, and revolutions. Like a child in new boots, leaping from puddle to puddle, this view sees history as leapfrogging from one bloodbath to the next, from World War I to World War II to the Cold War, from the Armenian Genocide to the Jewish Genocide to the Rwandan Genocide, from Robespierre to Lenin to Hitler. There is truth here, but this all-too-familiar list of calamities is somewhat misleading. We focus too much on the puddles and forget about the dry land separating them. The late modern era has seen unprecedented levels not only of violence and horror, but also of peace and tranquility. Charles Dickens wrote of the French Revolution that it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. This may be true not only of the French Revolution, but of the entire era it heralded. It is especially true of the 7 decades that have elapsed since the end of World War II. During this period, humankind has, for the first time, faced the possibility of complete self-annihilation and has experienced a fair number of actual wars and genocides. Yet these decades were also the most peaceful era in human history, and by a wide margin. This is surprising because these very same decades experienced more economic, social, and political change than any previous era. The tectonic plates of history are moving at a frantic pace, but the volcanoes are mostly silent. The new elastic order seems to be able to contain and even initiate radical structural changes without collapsing into violent conflict. Peace in our time. Most people don't appreciate just how peaceful an era we live in. None of us was alive 1,000 years ago, so we easily forget how much more violent the world used to be. And as wars become more rare, they attract more attention. Many more people think about the wars raging today in Afghanistan and Iraq than about the peace in which most Brazilians and Indians live. Even more importantly, it's easier to relate to the suffering of individuals than of entire populations. However, in order to understand macro-historical processes, we need to examine mass statistics rather than individual stories. In the year 2000, wars caused the deaths of 310,000 individuals, and violent crime killed another 520,000. Each and every victim is a world destroyed, a family ruined, friends and relatives scarred for life. Yet, from a macro perspective, these 830,000 victims comprised only 1.5% of the 56 million people who died in 2000. That year, 1.26 million people died in car accidents, 2.25% of total mortality, and 815,000 people committed suicide, 1.45%. The figures for 2002 are even more surprising. Out of 57 million dead, only 172,000 people died in war, and 569,000 died of violent crime, a total of 741,000 victims of human violence. In contrast, 873,000 people committed suicide. It turns out that in the year following the 9/11 attacks, despite all the talk of terrorism and war, the average person was more likely to kill himself than to be killed by a terrorist, a soldier, or a drug dealer. In most parts of the world, people go to sleep without fearing that in the middle of the night a neighbouring tribe might surround their village and slaughter everyone. Well-off British subjects travel daily from Nottingham to London through Sherwood Forest without fear that a gang of merry, green-clad brigands will ambush them and take their money to give to the poor, or, more likely, murder them and take the money for themselves. Students brook no canings from their teachers. Children need not fear that they will be sold into slavery when their parents can't pay their bills. And women know that the law forbids their husbands from beating them and forcing them to stay at home. Increasingly, around the world, these expectations are fulfilled. The decline of violence is due largely to the rise of the state. Throughout history, most violence resulted from local feuds between families and communities. Even today, as these figures indicate, local crime is a far deadlier threat than international wars. As we have seen, early farmers, who knew no political organizations larger than the local community, suffered rampant violence. As kingdoms and empires became stronger, they reined in communities and the level of violence decreased. In the decentralized kingdoms of medieval Europe, about 20 to 40 people were murdered each year for every 100,000 inhabitants. In recent decades, when states and markets have become all-powerful and communities have vanished, violence rates have dropped even further. Today, the global average is only 9 murders a year per 100,000 people, and most of these murders take place in weak states such as Somalia and Colombia. In the centralized states of Europe, the average is 1 murder a year per 100,000 people. There are certainly cases where states use their power to kill their own citizens, and these often loom large in our memories and fears. During the 20th century, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people were killed by the security forces of their own states. Still, from a macro perspective, state-run courts and police forces have probably increased the level of security worldwide. Even in oppressive dictatorships, the average modern person is far less likely to die at the hands of another person than in pre-modern societies. In 1964, a military dictatorship was established in Brazil. It ruled the country until 1985. During these 20 years, several thousand Brazilians were murdered by the regime. Thousands more were imprisoned and tortured. Yet, even in the worst years, the average Brazilian in Rio de Janeiro was far less likely to die at human hands than the average Waldani, Arawete, or Yanomamo are, indigenous people who live in the depths of the Amazon forest without army, police, or prisons. Anthropological studies have indicated that between a quarter and a half of their menfolk die sooner or later in violent conflicts over property, women, or prestige. Imperial retirement. It is perhaps debatable whether violence within states has decreased or increased since 1945. What nobody can deny is that international violence has dropped to an all-time low. Perhaps the most obvious example is the collapse of the European empires. Throughout history, empires have crushed rebellions with an iron fist, and when its day came, a sinking empire used all its might to save itself, usually collapsing into a bloodbath. Its final demise generally led to anarchy and wars of succession. Since 1945, most empires have opted for peaceful early retirement. Their process of collapse became relatively swift, calm, and orderly. In 1945, Britain ruled a quarter of the globe. 30 years later, it ruled just a few small islands. In the intervening decades, it retreated from most of its colonies in a peaceful and orderly manner. Though in some places, such as Malaya and Kenya, the British tried to hang on by force of arms, in most places they accepted the end of empire with a sigh rather than with a temper tantrum. They focused their efforts not on retaining power, but on transferring it as smoothly as possible. At least some of the praise usually heaped on Mahatma Gandhi for his non-violent creed is actually owed to the British Empire. Despite many years of bitter and often violent struggle, when the end of the Raj came, the Indians did not have to fight the British in the streets of Delhi and Calcutta. The empire's place was taken by a slew of independent states, most of which have since enjoyed stable borders and have, for the most part, lived peacefully alongside their neighbors. True, tens of thousands of people perished at the hands of the threatened British Empire, and in several hotspots its retreat led to the eruption of ethnic conflicts that claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, particularly in India. Yet, when compared to the long-term historical average, the British withdrawal was an exemplar of peace and order. The French Empire was more stubborn. Its collapse involved bloody rearguard actions in Vietnam and Algeria that cost hundreds of thousands of lives. Yet the French, too, retreated from the rest of their dominions quickly and peacefully, leaving behind orderly states rather than a chaotic free-for-all. The Soviet collapse in 1989 was even more peaceful, despite the eruption of ethnic conflict in the Balkans, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. Never before has such a mighty empire disappeared so swiftly and so quietly. The Soviet Empire of 1989 had suffered no military defeat except in Afghanistan, no external invasions, no rebellions, nor even large-scale Martin Luther King-style campaigns of civil disobedience. The Soviets still had millions of soldiers, tens of thousands of tanks and aeroplanes, and enough nuclear weapons to wipe out the whole of humankind several times over. The Red Army and the other Warsaw Pact armies remained loyal. Had the last Soviet ruler, Mikhail Gorbachev, given the order, the Red Army would have opened fire on the subjugated masses. Yet the Soviet elite and the communist regimes throughout most of Eastern Europe, Romania and Serbia were the exceptions, chose not to use even a tiny fraction of this military power. When its members realized that communism was bankrupt, they renounced force, admitted their failure, packed their suitcases, and went home. Gorbachev and his colleagues gave up without a struggle not only the Soviet conquests of World War II, but also the much older Tsarist conquests in the Baltic, the Ukraine, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. It is chilling to contemplate what might have happened if Gorbachev had behaved like the Serbian leadership, or like the French in Algeria. Pax Atomica. The independent states that came after these empires were remarkably uninterested in war. With very few exceptions, since 1945, states no longer invade other states in order to conquer and swallow them up. Such conquests had been the bread and butter of political history since time immemorial. It was how most great empires were established, and how most rulers and populations expected things to stay. But campaigns of conquest, like those of the Romans, Mongols, and Ottomans, cannot take place today anywhere in the world. Since 1945, no independent country recognized by the UN has been conquered and wiped off the map. Limited international wars still occur from time to time, and millions still die in wars, but wars are no longer the norm. Many people believe that the disappearance of international war is unique to the rich democracies of Western Europe. In fact, peace reached Europe after it prevailed in other parts of the world. Thus, the last serious international wars between South American countries were the Peru-Ecuador War of 1941 and the Bolivia-Paraguay War of 1932-5. And before that, there hadn't been a serious war between South American countries since 1879-84, with Chile on one side and Bolivia and Peru on the other. We seldom think of the Arab world as particularly peaceful, yet only once since the Arab countries won their independence has one of them mounted a full-scale invasion of another, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990. There have been quite a few border clashes, for example Syria versus Jordan in 1970, many armed interventions of one in the affairs of another, for example Syria in Lebanon, numerous civil wars, Algeria, Yemen, Libya, and an abundance of coups and revolts. Yet there have been no full-scale international wars among the Arab states except the Gulf War. Even widening the scope to include the entire Muslim world adds only one more example, the Iran-Iraq War. There was no Turkey-Iran War, Pakistan-Afghanistan War, or Indonesia-Malaysia War. In Africa, things are far less rosy. But even there, most conflicts are civil wars and coups. Since African states won their independence in the 1960s and 1970s, very few countries have invaded one another in the hope of conquest. There have been periods of relative calm before, as, for example, in Europe between 1871 and 1914, and they always ended badly. But this time it is different. For real peace is not the mere absence of war. Real peace is the implausibility of war. There has never been real peace in the world. Between 1871 and 1914, a European war remained a plausible eventuality, and the expectation of war dominated the thinking of armies, politicians, and ordinary citizens alike. This foreboding was true for all other peaceful periods in history. An iron law of international politics decreed, for every two nearby polities, There is a plausible scenario that will cause them to go to war against one another within 1 year. This law of the jungle was in force in late 19th century Europe, in medieval Europe, in ancient China, and in classical Greece. If Sparta and Athens were at peace in 450 BC, there was a plausible scenario that they would be at war by 449 BC. Today, humankind has broken the law of the jungle. There is at last real peace, and not just absence of war. For most polities, there is no plausible scenario leading to full-scale conflict within 1 year. What could lead to war between Germany and France next year? Or between China and Japan? Or between Brazil and Argentina? Some minor border clash might occur, but only a truly apocalyptic scenario could result in an old-fashioned full-scale war between Brazil and Argentina in 2014, with the Argentinian armored divisions sweeping to the gates of Rio, and Brazilian carpet bombers pulverizing the neighborhoods of Buenos Aires. Such wars might still erupt between several pairs of states, for example between Israel and Syria, Ethiopia and Eritrea, or the US and Iran, but these are only the exceptions that prove the rule. This situation might, of course, change in the future, and with hindsight, the world of today might seem incredibly naive. Yet, from a historical perspective, our very naivety is fascinating. Never before has peace been so prevalent that people could not even imagine war. Scholars have sought to explain this happy development in more books and articles than you would ever want to read yourself, and they have identified several contributing factors. First and foremost, the price of war has gone up dramatically. The Nobel Peace Prize to end all peace prizes should have been given to Robert Oppenheimer and his fellow architects of the atomic bomb. Nuclear weapons have turned war between superpowers into collective suicide, and made it impossible to seek world domination by force of arms. Secondly, while the price of war soared, its profits declined. For most of history, polities could enrich themselves by looting or annexing enemy territories. Most wealth consisted of material things like fields, cattle, slaves, and gold, so it was easy to loot it or occupy it. Today, wealth consists mainly of human capital and organizational know-how. Consequently, it is difficult to carry it off or conquer it by military force. Consider California. Its wealth was initially built on gold mines. But today it is built on silicon and celluloid, Silicon Valley and the celluloid hills of Hollywood. What would happen if the Chinese were to mount an armed invasion of California, land 1 million soldiers on the beaches of San Francisco, and storm inland? They would gain little. There are no silicon mines in Silicon Valley. The wealth resides in the minds of Google engineers and Hollywood script doctors, directors, and special effects wizards, who would be on the first plane to Bangalore or Mumbai long before the Chinese tanks rolled into Sunset Boulevard. It is not coincidental that the few full-scale international wars that still take place in the world, such as the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, occur in places where wealth is old-fashioned material wealth. The Kuwaiti sheikhs could flee abroad, but the oil fields stayed put and were occupied. While war became less profitable, peace became more lucrative than ever. In traditional agricultural economies, long-distance trade and foreign investment were sideshows. Consequently, peace brought little profit, aside from avoiding the costs of war. If, say, in 1400, England and France were at peace, the French did not have to pay heavy war taxes and to suffer destructive English invasions, but otherwise it did not benefit their wallets. In modern capitalist economies, foreign trade and investments have become all important. Peace, therefore, brings unique dividends. As long as China and the USA are at peace, the Chinese can prosper by selling products to the USA, trading in Wall Street, and receiving US investments. Last but not least, a tectonic shift has taken place in global political culture. Many elites in history, Hun chieftains, Viking noblemen, and Aztec priests, for example, viewed war as a positive good. Others viewed it as evil, but an inevitable one, which we had better turn to our own advantage. Ours is the first time in history that the world is dominated by a peace-loving elite. Politicians, business people, intellectuals, and artists who genuinely see war as both evil and avoidable. There were pacifists in the past, such as the early Christians, but in the rare cases that they gained power, they tended to forget about their requirement to turn the other cheek. There is a positive feedback loop between all these four factors. The threat of nuclear holocaust fosters pacifism. When pacifism spreads, war recedes and trade flourishes, and trade increases both the profits of peace and the costs of war. Over time, this feedback loop creates another obstacle to war, which may ultimately prove the most important of all. The tightening web of international connections erodes the independence of most countries, lessening the chance that any one of them might single-handedly let slip the dogs of war. Most countries no longer engage in full-scale war for the simple reason that they are no longer independent. Though citizens in Israel, Italy, Mexico, or Thailand may harbor illusions of independence, the fact is that their governments cannot conduct independent economic or foreign policies, and they are certainly incapable of initiating and conducting full-scale war on their own. As explained in Chapter 11, we are witnessing the formation of a global empire. Like previous empires, this one, too, enforces peace within its borders. And since its borders cover the entire globe, the world empire effectively enforces world peace. So, is the modern era one of mindless slaughter, war, and oppression, typified by the trenches of World War I, the nuclear mushroom cloud over Hiroshima, and the gory manias of Hitler and Stalin? Or is it an era of peace, epitomized by the trenches never dug in South America, the mushroom clouds that never appeared over Moscow and New York, and the serene visages of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King? The answer is a matter of timing. It is sobering to realize how often our view of the past is distorted by events of the last few years. If this chapter had been written in 1945 or 1962, it would probably have been much more glum. Since it was written in 2014, it takes a relatively buoyant approach to modern history. To satisfy both optimists and pessimists, we may conclude by saying that we are on the threshold of both heaven and hell, moving nervously between the gateway of the one and the anteroom of the other. History has still not decided where we will end up, and a string of coincidences might yet send us rolling in either direction. 19. And they lived happily ever after. The last 500 years have witnessed a breathtaking series of revolutions. The Earth has been united into a single ecological and historical sphere. The economy has grown exponentially, and humankind today enjoys the kind of wealth that used to be the stuff of fairy tales. Science and the Industrial Revolution have given humankind superhuman powers and practically limitless energy. The social order has been completely transformed, as have politics, daily life, and human psychology. But are we happier? Did the wealth humankind accumulated over the last 5 centuries translate into a newfound contentment? Did the discovery of inexhaustible energy resources open before us inexhaustible stores of bliss? Going further back, have the 70 or so turbulent millennia since the cognitive revolution made the world a better place to live? Was the late Neil Armstrong, whose footprint remains intact on the windless moon, happier than the nameless hunter-gatherer who 30,000 years ago left her handprint on a wall in Chauvet Cave? If not, what was the point of developing agriculture, cities, writing, coinage, empires, science, and industry? Historians seldom ask such questions. They do not ask whether the citizens of Uruk and Babylon were happier than their foraging ancestors, whether the rise of Islam made Egyptians more pleased with their lives, or how the collapse of the European empires in Africa have influenced the happiness of countless millions. Yet these are the most important questions one can ask of history. Most current ideologies and political programs are based on rather flimsy ideas concerning the real source of human happiness. Nationalists believe that political self-determination is essential for our happiness. Communists postulate that everyone would be blissful under the dictatorship of the proletariat. Capitalists maintain that only the free market can ensure the greatest happiness of the greatest number by creating economic growth and material abundance, and by teaching people to be self-reliant and enterprising. What would happen if serious research were to disprove these hypotheses? If economic growth and self-reliance do not make people happier, what's the benefit of capitalism? What if it turns out that the subjects of large empires are generally happier than the citizens of independent states, and that, for example, Ghanaians were happier under British colonial rule than under their own homegrown dictators? What would that say about the process of decolonization and the value of national self-determination? These are all hypothetical possibilities, because so far historians have avoided raising these questions, not to mention answering them. They have researched the history of just about everything: politics, society, economics, gender, diseases, sexuality, food, clothing, yet they have seldom stopped to ask how these influence human happiness. Though few have studied the long-term history of happiness, almost every scholar and layperson has some vague preconception about it. In one common view, human capabilities have increased throughout history. Since humans generally use their capabilities to alleviate miseries and fulfill aspirations, it follows that we must be happier than our medieval ancestors, and they must have been happier than Stone Age hunter-gatherers. But this progressive account is unconvincing. As we have seen, new aptitudes, behaviors, and skills do not necessarily make for a better life. When humans learn to farm in the agricultural revolution, their collective power to shape their environment increased, but the lot of many individual humans grew harsher. Peasants had to work harder than foragers to eke out less varied and nutritious food, and they were far more exposed to disease and exploitation. Similarly, the spread of European empires greatly increased the collective power of humankind by circulating ideas, technologies, and crops, and opening new avenues of commerce. Yet this was hardly good news for millions of Africans, Native Americans, and Aboriginal Australians. Given the proven human propensity for misusing power, it seems naive to believe that the more clout people have, the happier they will be. Some challengers of this view take a diametrically opposed position. They argue for a reverse correlation between human capabilities and happiness. Power corrupts, they say, and as humankind gained more and more power, it created a cold, mechanistic world ill-suited to our real needs. Evolution molded our minds and bodies to the life of hunter-gatherers. The transition, first to agriculture and then to industry, has condemned us to living unnatural lives that cannot give full expression to our inherent inclinations and instincts, and therefore cannot satisfy our deepest yearnings. Nothing in the comfortable lives of the urban middle class can approach the wild excitement and sheer joy experienced by a forager band on a successful mammoth hunt. Every new invention just puts another mile between us and the Garden of Eden. Yet this romantic insistence on seeing a dark shadow behind each invention is as dogmatic as the belief in the inevitability of progress. Perhaps we are out of touch with our inner hunter-gatherer, but it's not all bad. For instance, over the last two centuries, modern medicine has decreased child mortality from 33% to less than 5%. Can anyone doubt that this made a huge contribution to the happiness not only of those children who would otherwise have died, but also of their families and friends? A more nuanced position takes the middle road. Until the scientific revolution, there was no clear correlation between power and happiness. Medieval peasants may indeed have been more miserable than their hunter-gatherer forebears. But in the last few centuries, humans have learned to use their capacities more wisely. The triumphs of modern medicine are just one example. Other unprecedented achievements include the steep drop in violence, the virtual disappearance of international wars, and the near elimination of large-scale famines. Yet this, too, is an oversimplification. Firstly, it bases its optimistic assessment on a very small sample of years. The majority of humans began to enjoy the fruits of modern medicine no earlier than 1850, and the drastic drop in child mortality is a 20th century phenomenon. Mass famines continued to blight much of humanity up to the middle of the 20th century. During Communist China's Great Leap Forward of 1958 to 61, somewhere between 10 and 50 million human beings starved to death. International wars became rare only after 1945, largely thanks to the new threat of nuclear annihilation. Hence, though the last few decades have been an unprecedented golden age for humanity, it is too early to know whether this represents a fundamental shift in the currents of history or an ephemeral eddy of good fortune. When judging modernity, it is all too tempting to take the viewpoint of a 21st century middle-class Westerner. We must not forget the viewpoints of a 19th century Welsh coal miner, Chinese opium addict, or Tasmanian Aborigine. Truganini is no less important than Homer Simpson. Secondly, even the brief golden age of the last half century may turn out to have sown the seeds of future catastrophe. Over the last few decades, we have been disturbing the ecological equilibrium of our planet in myriad new ways, with what seem likely to be dire consequences. A lot of evidence indicates that we are destroying the foundations of human prosperity in an orgy of reckless consumption. Finally, we can congratulate ourselves on the unprecedented accomplishments of modern sapiens only if we completely ignore the fate of all other animals. Much of the vaunted material wealth that shields us from disease and famine was accumulated at the expense of laboratory monkeys, dairy cows, and conveyor belt chickens. Over the last two centuries, tens of billions of them have been subjected to a regime of industrial exploitation whose cruelty has no precedent in the annals of planet Earth. If we accept a mere tenth of what animal rights activists are claiming, then modern industrial agriculture might well be the greatest crime in history. When evaluating global happiness, it is wrong to count the happiness only of the upper classes, of Europeans, or of men. Perhaps it is also wrong to consider only the happiness of humans. Counting happiness. So far, we have discussed happiness as if it were largely a product of material factors, such as health, diet, and wealth. If people are richer and healthier, then they must also be happier. But is that really so obvious? Philosophers, priests, and poets have brooded over the nature of happiness for millennia, and many have concluded that social, ethical, and spiritual factors have as great an impact on our happiness as material conditions. Perhaps people in modern affluent societies suffer greatly from alienation and meaninglessness despite their prosperity. And perhaps our less well-to-do ancestors found much contentment in community, religion, and a bond with nature. In recent decades, psychologists and biologists have taken up the challenge of studying scientifically what really makes people happy. Is it money, family, genetics, or perhaps virtue? The first step is to define what is to be measured. The generally accepted definition of happiness is subjective well-being. Happiness, according to this view, is something I feel inside myself, a sense of either immediate pleasure or long-term contentment with the way my life is going. If it's something felt inside, how can it be measured from outside? Presumably, we can do so by asking people to tell us how they feel. So psychologists or biologists who want to assess how happy people feel give them questionnaires to fill out and tally the results. A typical subjective well-being questionnaire asks interviewees to grade on a scale of 0 to 10 their agreement with statements such as, "I feel pleased with the way I am. I feel that life is very rewarding. I am optimistic about the future." And "Life is good." The researcher then adds up all the answers and calculates the interviewee's general level of subjective well-being. Such questionnaires are used in order to correlate happiness with various objective factors. One study might compare 1,000 people who earn $100,000 a year with 1,000 people who earn $50,000. If the study discovers that the first group has an average subjective well-being level of 8.7, while the latter has an average of only 7.3, the researcher may reasonably conclude that there is a positive correlation between wealth and subjective well-being. To put it in simple English, money brings happiness. The same method can be used to examine whether people living in democracies are happier than people living in dictatorships, and whether married people are happier than singles, divorcees, or widowers. This provides a grounding for historians who can examine wealth, political freedom, and divorce rates in the past. If people are happier in democracies and married people are happier than divorcees, a historian has a basis for arguing that the democratization process of the last few decades contributed to the happiness of humankind, whereas the growing rates of divorce indicate an opposite trend. This way of thinking is not flawless, but before pointing out some of the holes, it is worth considering the findings. One interesting conclusion is that money does indeed bring happiness, but only up to a point, and beyond that point it has little significance. For people stuck at the bottom of the economic ladder, more money means greater happiness. If you are an American single mother earning $12,000 a year cleaning houses, and you suddenly win $500,000 in the lottery, you will probably experience a significant and long-term surge in your subjective well-being. You'll be able to feed and clothe your children without sinking further into debt. However, if you're a top executive earning $250,000 a year, and you win $1 million in the lottery, or your company board suddenly decides to double your salary, your surge is likely to last only a few weeks. According to the empirical findings, it's almost certainly not going to make a big difference to the way you feel over the long run. You'll buy a snazzier car, move into a palatial home, get used to drinking Chateau Petrus instead of California Cabernet, but it'll soon all seem routine and unexceptional. Another interesting finding is that illness decreases happiness in the short term, but is a source of long-term distress only if a person's condition is constantly deteriorating, or if the disease involves ongoing and debilitating pain. People who are diagnosed with chronic illness, such as diabetes, are usually depressed for a while, but if the illness does not get worse, they adjust to their new condition and rate their happiness as highly as healthy people do. Imagine that Lucy and Luke are middle-class twins who agree to take part in a subjective well-being study. On the way back from the psychology laboratory, Lucy's car is hit by a bus, leaving Lucy with a number of broken bones and a permanently lame leg. Just as the rescue crew is cutting her out of the wreckage, the phone rings, and Luke shouts that he has won the lottery's $10 million jackpot. 2 years later, she'll be limping and he'll be a lot richer, but when the psychologist comes around for a follow-up study, they are both likely to give the same answers they did on the morning of that fateful day. Family and community seem to have more impact on our happiness than money and health. People with strong families who live in tight-knit and supportive communities are significantly happier than people whose families are dysfunctional and who have never found, or never sought, a community to be part of. Marriage is particularly important. Repeated studies have found that there is a very close correlation between good marriages and high subjective well-being, and between bad marriages and misery. This holds true irrespective of economic or even physical conditions. An impecunious invalid surrounded by a loving spouse, a devoted family and a warm community may well feel better than an alienated billionaire, provided that the invalid's poverty is not too severe and that his illness is not degenerative or painful. This raises the possibility that the immense improvement in material conditions over the last two centuries was offset by the collapse of the family and the community. If so, the average person might well be no happier today than in 1800. Even the freedom we value so highly may be working against us. We can choose our spouses, friends, and neighbors, but they can choose to leave us. With the individual wielding unprecedented power to decide her own path in life, we find it ever harder to make commitments. We thus live in an increasingly lonely world of unraveling communities and families. But the most important finding of all is that happiness does not really depend on objective conditions of either wealth, health, or even community. Rather, it depends on the correlation between objective conditions and subjective expectations. If you want a bullock cart and get a bullock cart, you are content. If you want a brand new Ferrari and get only a second-hand Fiat, you feel deprived. This is why winning the lottery has, over time, the same impact on people's happiness as a debilitating car accident. When things improve, expectations balloon, and consequently even dramatic improvements in objective conditions can leave us dissatisfied. When things deteriorate, expectations shrink,